That long title promises more than I will deliver. I just want to say these are undergraduates I've worked with, except for that guy who's actually a faculty member. A lot of what I'm saying is in these two recent posts to the archive that I hope will be accepted soon. I call them 1-2-few-1, 1-2-3, and 1-2-few-2-n, which I think is funny. But I can see that's an acquired kind of thing. Right. okay. First, an outline of my talk. All right. Okay. Thank you. Good night. Okay. So what am I doing here? So I have this here, right? I have Newton's cradle. Which was named so, as I understand from Wikipedia, by a Shakespearean actor. It was originally called the Executive Ball Clicker, and some Shakespearean actor just decided when they were marketing it that was a better name. Devices like this were presented to the fellow, the Royal Society, by Christopher Wren, by Christopher Huygens, somebody else who's famous. Why do we use these again? Why does every single physics department have one of these? Blah, blah, blah. Yeah. What, somebody want to volunteer to say? Not all shout out. This is a raise a hand kind of environment. Anybody want to volunteer? Why do we use this?
Collisions.
We're studying collisions, and that's why they were introduced, right? And in particular, what was one of the essential puzzles of early classical mechanics that a device like this was meant to help tease out? What was an early debate about motion and collisions? Momentum or energy, which is conserved, which of them is appropriate, are they both physical ideas? And part of why we use this, right, one of the standard examples that I use from Mazur's book, right, so I pull the one back and I get the one out, right? And so then we can ask the question, well, why don't, if I pull two back, why do I get two out and not one going twice as fast? Right, or some other thing like that, right? So we use this because this tool is a great tool for teaching about collisions, conservation of momentum, conservation of energy, and how both of those give us something different. But if this was a perfect system, how many conserved quantities are there in this system? This was a truly, so, and what do I mean by truly perfect? That these balls are infinitely hard, and so the duration of contact is infinitesimal. And what else do I want? And again, all the collision, it's truly one-dimensional. How many conserved quantities would I have for this particular setup? You'd have six. You actually would have six. What's amazing about this system is classically, there are six integrals of the motion, six conserved quantities for six balls. And if you had n balls, you'd have n conserved quantities. One way to think about this is in this system, every relative velocity is conserved in collisions. And you sort of know that that's a fun trick, right? When you're solving this problem, you do the conservation of energy, you do the conservation of momentum, and then the clever way to do it is to divide, is to rearrange the conservation of energy and then divide by the rearranged conservation of momentum, and that you get a conservation of relative velocity. Well, it turns out that's not just that's true for each collision, and you can generate a set of n conserved quantities for n of these balls. This is an integrable system, right? You have that, you have as many constants of motion as you need to totally separate it every way you want. Now again, what are the key assumptions here in this physical system? Because you see what happens every time I do this, right? Is I start, and long before I actually lose the energy of the system, I start getting a conversion of the energy from sort of one, I'll call it a mode, although that's maybe a little bit of a sloppy speaking, right? To suddenly I have this just total sloshing of all the energy. We could loosely call that thermalization, right? Instead of having the energy in one sort of box suddenly the energy is now spread out into all the different boxes in an equal way, right? We're going to have an increase of entropy in a very sort of... So in this system, this is not a perfect system. It's UCSB. Oh, that was just a weird joke. I don't even know what that means. But I mean, like, this is not a perfect system. What drives this? What drives the thermalization? Anybody know? They're not perfectly hard. And what problem does that make? Well, we remember that when we teach collisions, one of the things we have to say to our students is, you can use conservation of momentum in this car collision as long as the interval of the collision is so short that the external forces, which surely exist, will deliver no sizable impulse to the system, right? And so then you just do momentum before, momentum after. Well, in this system, these strings will deliver an impulse if the collision is no longer infinitesimal. And so in fact, right, and more generally, if you do this sloppily, like if I just sort of, like in principle, I could do any sort of initial condition, and it would be still an integrable system. I'll be there in a second. But more generally, what you could say is what thermalizes this system are three-body collisions, whether they're two real bodies and this is the other one, or whether it's actual, you have, because of finite duration, you actually have three bodies hitting at the same time.
Now, if I close my eyes, I can still say something about that, right?
Sure.
If I close my eyes and you do that experiment, oh. You could ask me, is this conservative? I can give you an answer.
That's right. So I haven't included the fact that there are actual other kinds of dissipation, right? Whether we're talking about the actual, vibrational modes of the ball, exciting, right? So you're absolutely right. But that kind of dissipation, one would expect, if that was the only kind, one might expect that it just would be smaller, ding, 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 ding. But that's not the dominant time scale of, right? That's not what dominates it. The thermalization, the internal things are what dominates that. Okay, so Newton's cradle. So the question is, can we make this quantum? Right? And so here would be, and here is a Hamiltonian that a lot of people are studying right now, and this is sometimes called the quantum Newton's cradle, right? So what do we have? We have the kinetic energy and the potential energy, and we just, maybe it's a little bit of whatever, right? So we have a sum of one of just identical particle systems, and then we have a contact interaction, right? The true limit of a contact interaction. Now, when we go to the quantum level, what are the interesting new features? Well, of course, here I have no tunneling. Now I can say, so in other words, this system is truly g goes to infinity, or 1 over g goes to 0. That is sometimes called the unitary limit, right? Where the amount of scattering is as big as it can be. And this is a one-dimensional system, and so that is a different thing than in three dimensions. Of course, we have identical particles, which means that, these are distinguishable. I cannot distinguish these particles, and so we may have to do some sort of symmetrization to account to bosons and fermions. And we could even have spins or internal components. So either true angular momentum spin or just some other internal electronic structure, ISO structure, ISO spin, that does this. So the interest in this is not purely academic. Oh, yeah. Although, I tell you, I don't like the name Newton's cradle. I like Schrodinger's cradle. I think that's sort of cool, right? Partially, of course, because Schrodinger invented entanglement, and I use this system as a crucible for understanding entanglement. I also really like the idea of quantum abacus. And there's something else in the literature that's already called quantum abacus, but I like the name of that because here we sort of have this in a parabolic trap or nearly a sinusoidal bottom, but you can also do this pretty approximately just sort of with a hard wall, and that really would be like an abacus. You can also, of course, solve this on a ring and have periodic boundary conditions.
Since you mentioned the quantum abacus, have you explored connections with quantum information theory in this system?
That is what I am exploring, and I'll maybe get a little bit of it. I don't have. What I would love to find is a killer app, right? And I don't think I have that yet, but what I hope to show you is by showing you how much symmetry is in this system, I have a fantasy that you can use number theory, that you could do at least some kinds of number theory on this, even if it's something as, have you seen a Talbot carpet? Yeah, with a line of ions, and you sort of have these coherence patterns that trace out in time. And if you sort of trace the coherences in time as time steps, you see these woven patterns of coherence. And you can even factor with a Talbot carpet. So I have fantasies, but I'm not going to talk about those fantasies in public. Okay. Yeah?
Is V the potential for the pendulum?
Yeah, that's right. So maybe that's good. Let's go up there again and say, so I'll often call this the one-body potential,
yeah,
or the trap shape.
Okay.
Yeah, right? And so we'll see that what I, maybe let's just start jabbering, but what I really want to do, right, is, or one of the questions I'm very interested in, is how much of the physics depends on the trap shape? How much of it, like certain traps are very easy to do the math on, but how much of the physics really depends on the trap shape? Because we're never going to have a perfect harmonic or a perfect sinusoid. And so, yeah, good. So can you do this? Yes, you can do this. This is the Nature paper that is titled A Quantum Newton's Cradle. You know, I actually don't know where these people are.
Penn State,
okay. Yeah, and so so I'll sort of describe the setup here in a second, but picture a Bose-Einstein condensate in a one-dimensional tube. Can't just pull one atom back and let it go, but you can kick it with a wave and sort of cause an initial disturbance like this, and then you watch it sloshing back coherently. And again, this stays coherent for a very, very long time, and this coherence is a sign that you're really in this integrable regime and that you're not getting thermalization of these disturbances. You're really having long-term coherent oscillations of this Bose-Einstein condensate. And so this is 2006. There's a whole bunch of people, I don't know, four or five labs at least, who are really very invested in these one-dimensional tubes of cold atoms. I'm going to give you just a totally ludicrous theorist cartoon. You have a gas of atoms. You put it in some sort of trap, a magneto-optic trap, some combination of electric and magnetic fields. Maybe you shoot it with some sort of, lasers. And the lasers make it cold, right? The lasers make it cold, and so it condenses either into Bose-Einstein condensate if you've got bosons, or maybe to a degenerate Fermi gas if you've got fermions, or maybe it's just cold. Maybe you have other ways of doing things. Then shoot more lasers at it, right? And you can use these lasers to make it into an egg crate or a three-dimensional lattice, or right? And you can even do things like they can even somewhat deterministically make some sort of lattice with a certain number of atoms in each tube. Now, I've sort of drawn this way, but what you should be picturing is the tubes going this way, and this is like the, well, maybe you should picture something else. But then you can also turn on more fields, more magnetic fields, and you can actually tune by tuning sort of the internal structure, by tuning Feshbach resonances, really tune that G. And so you might argue, wait, there's a lot of stuff you're brushing under the rug here because we have these two other dimensions. What are those energy scales? How does scattering work in one, or how does three-dimensional scattering boil down to one dimension? That's stuff has been established that this is a good model. And so I'm really going to work with my model Hamiltonian. And yes, of course, if I was going to model a true experiment, I would have to look at the order of magnitude. But I'm looking at the mathematical structure of my Hamiltonian, which is shown to be a pretty good model for this, right? Oh, here's just one more picture. And again, the other one was with bosons. But like, people are studying this system because they're interested in magnets. Right, because you could put a bunch of fermions in these tubes and look at how the spin spatial correlations adjust as you tune parameters. One could imagine, like, this Hamiltonian was once called the Stoner Hamiltonian. Because it was an early Hamiltonian to look for magnetism. It's related to, there's a whole bunch of, this is, yeah, well, anyway, I'm just not going to go into all the history, but there's a lot of history here. Say what? And maybe I'll just say, and again, as a theorist, I'm just going to say, in my world as a theorist, there's a lot of knobs, right? And I can imagine tuning the trap shape, tuning the interaction strength, doing it fast, doing it slow, right? I can imagine these things, even if practically there are some limitations. Another fun thing is they can tilt the lattice by putting on an external field. So you can really do a lot of stuff. And then you can make a lot of measurements. You can, a classic thing you do is you have all these atoms. If they form some sort of bound state, well then that releases energy, right, and they're sort of kicked out of the trap, so you can look at loss rate, depending on how you tune parameters. You know that if you, right, this is a standard sort of quantum mechanics problem, you turn off the trap and you let it free expand, the spatial distribution you get at long time is the Fourier transform of the momentum, short term, or did I say that right? Something like that, right? In other words, you can infer from the spatial distribution at long time what the momentum distribution was when you turned off the trap. There are people who are even now looking at a specific few body observables. People are talking about, and I haven't seen, I guess I may not be totally up to date, people are talking about actually using radio frequency waves to actually tune the electronic levels of the few body states. So in other words, really do selective manipulation there. Or again, people sort of tilting it out and looking at how fast stuff tunnels out of your trap and using that to infer something about the wave functions. So the experimentalists, in principle, for theorists, I can start just inventing observables and there's enough knobs and there's enough things here that I can imagine someone clever will figure it out. That's somewhat irresponsible. And then again, I'm not even really going to talk too much about the coupling to the spin degrees of freedom. There's a lot of excitement about this here, or either spin or isospin, and the possibilities of this basically really big finite dimensional Hilbert space that you can tune a bunch of parameters and have pretty cool control over, pretty explicit control over. So. Yeah, so that's part of the motivation, right, is that you've got this system that you can control pretty well. Yeah, and again, there's lots of things known, right? This model has different names. I'm not going to go through all this. Some famous names I'll just shout out, Girardot, and maybe say that certainly when G is zero, then you just have a sum of identical particle Hamiltonians. When G is infinity, goes to positive infinity, that limit is also exactly solvable, meaning that, again, if you know the non-interacting states, you can find exact algebraic expressions for the unitary limit interacting states. And Girardot sort of is the first one who gets the claim for that, or Tonks, sometimes Tonks Girardot gas. So without going into too much detail in the history, that's something that is known. And again, if your one body potential is either homogeneous, like on a ring with periodic boundary conditions, or in an infinite well, this is exactly solvable for every G by the Bethe-Ansatz. And the Bethe-Ansatz is basically just saying it works like a Newton's cradle. Right? Not exactly, because it can take into account the fact that there's tunneling, but basically, if the Bethe-Ansatz is that it works like a Newton's cradle. Also, when this is harmonic and there are two bodies, there's the Bush et al. Solution for that. Now, Bush et al. Gets the credit. I've recently found out that people have written this solution at least as far back as 1983 in the literature, including an AJP. So, anyway, so things are known about this system. And I'm not, so I will sometimes say things that I have come up with and sometimes say things that are just known. And I know which is which and you don't. So why, again, am I doing this? Because we can. This kind of precise experimental control is so amazing that they're awarding Nobel Prizes for it. A particular physical question that is of interest across a lot of different subdisciplines, whether you're talking about AMO or stat-mech or nuclear physics or high-energy particle physics, is one of the many notions of universality. Universality is used locally, sometimes with real variation. A famous example in atomic and nuclear physics is the Efimov trimer, which this says that if you have three particles interacting via a very, very short-range force that is also very, very weak, so weak there are no two-body bound states, you can still have three-body bound state solutions, and that this, the physics of these three-body states depends very weakly or not at all on the exact nature of the interactions or the systems that are interacting. This is just something that happens. You know, I think of universality the same way as when I tell my students in introductory physics, we're talking about the ideal gas law, right? Just think of all the molecules as hard balls. And right, I can treat, whether I'm talking about some complex methane gas or I'm talking about helium, just treat the molecule as a hard ball, and that's going to work really well over a wide range of things. And so that's a kind of universality too, right? These are the Borromean rings, right? If I were to suddenly cut the red ring, all three of them fall apart. But no two rings, so in other words, no two rings are bound in this system. They're only bound by the presence of all three. So this is both a metaphor and a symbol for the Efimov trimer, and really a good, strong quantitative metaphor. Again, quantum simulations. I already talked a little bit about quantum magnetism in quantum systems, or whatever, quantum magnetism. And who knows? I mean, I'm doing one-dimensional people, but people study lots of different kinds of effects you can do. You can change the dimension and do lots of interesting things. Right, and who knows? Again, maybe these devices are, because of the amount of coherent control, the degrees of freedom, the proximity of the degrees of freedom, maybe this is a feasible working medium for quantum information processing. But why me? Why am I working on this? Well, as with any research project, some combination of chance, contingency, stubbornness, and vanity, right? Like, you know, one of my colleagues is thinking about ultra-cold atomic systems, Phil Johnson. He sort of got me to start thinking about it. You suddenly are just flipping through the archive, you see some paper, and you say, those people are idiots, or those people are geniuses. And that gets you down some sort of train where just a bit of luck, some sort of history of background. A lot of people are using techniques from solid state to study this, or field theory to study this system. Not as many people come from a background in which, you know, sort of group representation theory is the primary tool, and so there is sort of a gap in the literature for me to fill. And again, vanity. I published one paper on it, and people cited it. So it's like, hey, let's keep hitting this thing until it drains of all life. Also, I have an intellectual motivation for this, and based on my past work, right? So I'm really interested in entanglement, in interacting systems like particles, which have spatial degrees of freedom and spin degrees of freedom, and thinking about entanglement in these complicated systems. Because, you know, I always give the example of the hydrogen atom. In the ground state of the hydrogen atom, the electron and the proton are highly entangled. Right? Now, I mean, a lot of it, you know, in principle, like, depending on how you calculate it, and I haven't seen a good calculation, but depending on how you calculate it, you could just sort of pull qubits out of there at will, you know, right? And so the question is this kind of entanglement, the entanglement we get when particles interact, a real usable resource in terms of pulling entanglement out of things? And also sometimes entanglement in these systems looks a little different. One of the problems that got me into thinking about this is I went to a conference, and somebody was talking about how the entanglement between the spins of particles is not a relativistic invariant. So if you have two particles with interacting spin, and then you boost to some different reference frame, you will not always, it can depend on geometry and certain kinds of states, you will not find that the entanglement between those two particle spins is a relativistic invariant. I was puzzled. Now, I'll tell you, if you look at even one particle, you could even define entanglement between spin and momentum. And you will find that that also is not a relativistic invariant, because in relativity, how you count spin versus orbital angular momentum or momentum, that depends on your reference frame. And this fact is rediscovered every 10 years by some graduate student in some, this is both a classical and a quantum effect, and it's rediscovered every 10 years, and somebody tries to make a big stir out of it, whether it's oscillating black holes or whether we're talking about some quantum effect. But this is a known thing. And when you go to two particles, if you talk about entanglement between the two particles, that's a relativistic invariant.
So a lot of, this is not my field, but a lot of quantum computing and quantum cryptography relies on entanglement does that mean that the security of the message depends on the reference frame? Does that mean that the function of the computer depends?
There are certainly people who are thinking about this and thinking about how you can code any information you would want into relativistically invariant things. Again, the entanglement between particles, that's a relativistic invariant. It's just that not the entanglement between just the spin degrees of freedom of the particles. Right? So it depends on what observables you're talking about, what entanglement even means, and what's invariant and what's not invariant. So I thought this is all very interesting, right? And it got me thinking a lot about, and so this is symmetry, solvability, algebraic solvability, controllability, entanglement, coherence, integrability. Like, I don't even know what most of these words mean. Sometimes they're related, sometimes they're not related. They have different meanings in classical and quantum contexts, and relativistic and non-relativistic. So I don't understand this, but there's something, the future. Anyway, this is something that I'm interested in, and this particular system is a great, again, crucible for thinking about this. I want to take a little side note, and many of you probably know this incredibly well, but I still think it's worth going through to talk a little bit about what I even mean by algebraic solvability, right? So we have our quadratic equation, and whatever complex numbers A, B, and C are, I know this, right? For every single value of A, B, and C, I have this solution, and so, right, sure, I have to do this. You know, even if these were integers, I may have to introduce radicals and complex numbers. So in other words, I may have to increase my scope, but once I get to a certain stage, I've got everything. And so, right, you know, when we talk about something being elegant in physics, we sometimes mean it really compresses a lot into a single formulation, to a single formula. So this is certainly, this is simplicity, this is elegance, this is information. How many of you have used the quadratic equation in your research? Yeah. Okay. You've used. You haven't. Okay. So let's be serious. So who's actually used the algebraic solutions, the cubic equation, in their research? All right. Right. So I haven't very much, but I have occasionally, and really mostly in sort of pedagogical settings. Who's used the quartic? Yeah. You've used the quartic. Yeah. I've had Mathematica spit me out a quartic before, or something that I knew was equivalent to this kind of thing, right? Okay, how many of you have used the quintic solution? How many of you have used it? Okay, right, so does not exist. As we have known since Galois proved using group theory at the beginning of the 19th century. And what I always need to make sure that is clear here, right, is that, you know, of course, for specific values of A, B, C, D, and E here, there are algebraic solutions. And this was, you know, a craze for people to would find out, oh, I can do it if E is 2D minus B or whatever, right? Or whatever the relationships were. And people kept getting so excited, and there was this race to do it until finally Galois proved that it was not provable, okay? So in some sense, if you want to know why 5 is different with 5 particles, you could say that all I'm saying is that for some of these systems, when you get to 5 particles, even when you're doing weak perturbations, you get a quintic equation. So I hate to give the punchline away like that and sort of trivialize it like that, but I don't think it's trivial, because I don't think this is a trivial result, and I think that solvability and non-solvability and integrability, this is a real interesting physical question that at a PUI, I don't have to race to results. I can linger and appreciate when there are solvable systems, right? And when there aren't solvable systems, and to really think about what that tells me about physics and about mathematical physics, I admit it. Okay, right. And so in particular in this system, the way I phrase the question, one way I phrase the question I'm interested in is algebraic universality. So again, we're looking for properties that maybe don't depend on what the trap is, don't depend on the exact nature or we want to know how much do we have to know to get an algebraic solution, right? So, and my strategy is I identify symmetries for various contact, and I'll talk about the contact interaction today. I've thought about various other two-body and even three- and four-body interactions. What happens if you throw in spin to the symmetries? And then again, see, the question is how much can you figure out about few-body observables in terms of the one-particle energies and wave functions, and in terms of the two-body matrix elements of the interaction? Okay, so that's sort of the game, and I won't dwell on the details. Let's see if we can... and here's the big results, but I won't even dwell on this either, right? I mean, so I definitely was a stamp collector as a child, and sort of classifying and sorting things. And so, for me, this is a really big result. And I'll try to explain what I'm doing here. This is a result for configuration space symmetries, which are a subset of symmetries that we heard from Sean about a little bit, right? If we think about configuration space, the symmetries of configuration space, where these are what some people call, and I follow, kinematic symmetries. These are the full symmetries of the Hamiltonian. And I'll try to give some examples of that in a second. But they are classified by this. And so configuration space, kinematic space, S with a subscript number will always be a symmetric group, the group of permutations of n objects. C1 will always be the configuration space symmetry of the trap itself, which in one dimension is either parity or not parity. K1 can be a little bit more general, and I'll give examples. That's the kinematic symmetry of the one particle system. And so this just tells you how to sort of, in these three cases, non-interacting, generic Galilean invariant interactions, and contact interactions. And you see that when you go, you lose symmetry when you turn on the interactions, and then you actually get some symmetry restored when you get back to infinite interactions. And again, people know this because you can do a bunch of algebra here, but this is a different way of thinking about why the unitary limit is special and why you can do algebra there. Okay, and again, secret motivation, I'm interested in integrability, separability, and entanglement. Very abstractly, what I sort of talked about particles and finding the right observables to extract entanglement from the system, and directly whether these particular controllable systems can be used as a quantum information processing resource. So we're about 40 minutes in, and that's my motivation. Right? So, all right. So again, so in some sense, I'm actually serious. The rest of this is details. If I was going to try to make you take away anything else about this next section, and I don't want to go shock and awe here, but I want to sort of give an impression of, especially in one-dimensional systems, when I say symmetry, people are like, parity or doesn't. Maybe they remember that there's permutation symmetry. But there's a lot of different kinds of symmetries possible in one dimension. And then if you add in the fact that you've got multiple particles, you can have emergent symmetries. So I'm going to try to give some examples of this. And again, it's more of a potpourri of the kinds of symmetries that can emerge in few-body systems in one dimension. And again, I claim these are useful. So, yeah, so there's the Hamiltonian we're talking about. I'll talk a little bit about all of these, but let's start with configuration space symmetries, and maybe I won't even give... So what do I mean by configuration space symmetry? Well, first off, I'm going to be considering, you know, various one-dimensional traps like this. So I'm really considering what I mean by a trap is all of these, which have their various forms, right, have a non-degenerate spectrum. The states alternate in parity. And again, I'm real traps, so there's not some continuous part of the spectrum somewhere else. They're all bound states. Again, this is an approximation for a real experiment, but this is what I'm talking about. And so again, these have parity, these don't. That one doesn't. So now what if you think about two particles, right? And you take those same traps, and you look at them, you draw the equipotentials in configuration space. And so the point I'm going to try to make here is already you can see some sort of emergent phenomenon, maybe some weak sense of emergence. Right? So we see, of course, the harmonic oscillator. What a beauty, right? We have full O2 symmetry. Right? We have all possible rotations and reflections in this plane. We see that all the other parity symmetric ones have D4 symmetry, the symmetry of a square, right? So, and there's 8 symmetries of a square, nothing. Reflect horizontal, reflect vertical, reflect diagonal, and then rotate by a quarter, rotate by minus a quarter, and rotate by half. right? And just to remind you that total inversion would be rotation by pi, right? And so you can sort of think about what each of these mean, right? Like, so if this is Q1 and this is Q2, then reflection along the vertical is just flipping the parity of the first particle and not the second. And if they're not interacting, then that's a symmetry operation. When they're interacting, that's broken. You can't just suddenly flip one particle to the other side. But if they're not interacting, you can flip each particle's parity independently. Okay, so then here's the kind of stuff that I really like. So D4 is not an abelian group. What do I mean by that, right? So D4, it depends with the old dollar bill trick, right? You could fold it and rotate it and rotate it and fold it, and you get a different orientation of the dollar bill. If you have a non-abelian group, then you immediately know that at least some of the energy eigenvalues will be degenerate, because you can't diagonalize a non-abelian group for every state. There'll be some states which are just totally symmetric, and some states which are maybe symmetric under half and anti-symmetric under the other half. But there can be states that so there's this connection between symmetry and degeneracy, and we all sort of know this, but it's just sort of nice to see this already emerging here. And again, you put on interactions, you lose a lot of symmetry. You still have, so now these, in configuration space, these all have the same symmetry now. This one still has half as much symmetry. This still only has one reflection. These all have one reflection and one rotation. These drop down to D2, and that's just D1. Okay. You can do it in three dimensions. Right? Here's one equipotential, just sort of fun facts. Right? So I didn't know this. So if you draw the equipotentials for the V trap, and here's the equipotentials for the infinite square well trap, well, we know all I do when I go from here to here is I'm taking my exponent from 1 to infinity. And so, right, I didn't know that the octahedron, that's one way to do the duality between the octahedron and the cube. These two shapes have the same symmetry. They're just the different, right? You're just mapping vertices to faces. So that's just sort of a fun fact when you look at these things. And again, you see, here's our square well. I didn't do the double well because it didn't look right. But again, you see, if you have an asymmetric trap, you do not have as much symmetry. And again, these are all classifiable. You could sort of, and if you turn on the interactions, you can think of the interactions as planes that sector configuration space. So you have three possible, you know, 1 and 2, 2 and 3, 3 and 1. And in one dimension, these planes, these coincidence planes, divide configuration space in half. In two dimensions, it doesn't work like that, right? In two dimensions, if one wants to go to the other side of two, it can go around. So there's no sectioning of configuration space by their coincidence. But in one dimension, they have to go through. And what that looks like sort of topologically, right, is that, again, coincidence of particles causes an ordering arrangement of configuration space. And so each of these six sections have a different order. You could talk about the symmetry of configuration space with and without interactions. You can also restrict yourself down to just the relative plane. If you have no trap, the shape space for this is just phi goes from 0 to 30 degrees. So that's the only shape space. You can sort of reduce this down. So, I mean, it's a one-dimensional problem. So, anyway, I thought that was sort of fun from Sean's talk. You can do stuff in four. Oh, no, first, you can do math. I mean, like, why do we care? Why do we want these kinds of things? I mean, there's a whole machinery, as I sort of alluded to, right? Once you have the symmetry classified, there's a whole machinery. You can construct symmetry-adapted bases, right? You can, you can make certain algebraic calculations simpler, and you can make certain, you know that there's no matrix elements between certain kinds of things, and yeah. You can do it in four. And this is a fun game, and I've had some students help me try to figure out how to think. Here's just the relative configuration space. In the relative configuration space, these are, this has octahedral symmetry, the same symmetry as a cube. And so you could think about, like, These red lines are the intersection of three coincidence planes. So these are the lines where three particles are on top of each other and one's floating around somewhere else. The blue ones are 2-2 cluster lines in configuration space. And so you can, again, sort of think about shapes and scale. And you know, you can even make wave functions and look and see where their maxima are and understand from that, oh, this is sort of a 3-1 cluster kind of state, right? Even from graphically constructing the wave functions. Again, there's a bunch of stuff here. So I've been talking about just this line right here, non-interacting. When you turn on the interaction, so here what this means is you have each particle has its own parity, if it's a symmetric trap, and then you can mix the particles around. But when you mix the particles around, you also are mixing their parities, and so it's not a direct product; it's called a semi-direct product. Because they don't commute. You can't switch a particle's parity, then switch particles. You'll get a different thing than if you switch the particles and then switch the same particle's parity. So that's what that symbol that doesn't even exist on my computer, and I have to draw by hand, means. And there's even debate in the literature which way the little bar should be. So then, but when you turn on the interactions, you break that individual particles, but you still have the overall trap symmetry, and you still have permutation symmetry. And then, what I've only alluded to, but which is almost the most exciting result for me, is that when you go to the unitary limit, you get this ordering. And this ordering is another copy of permutation symmetry that commutes with it and is totally independent of it. Now, what do I mean? Right? So I could call this particle Alice, Bob, Charles, Diana, etc. And I could either say I'm going to switch Alice and Bob, right? I could switch Alice and Charlie. But I could also talk about, I don't know what configuration this in, but I'm always going to switch the first and the third particle. And those may not be Alice and Charlie, right? But both of those are, you know, both of those are they commute with each other. It doesn't matter what order you do them in, and they're different symmetries. And so I would say that this is my big result, and maybe the people who are most familiar with unitarity and universality in atom physics is that ordering permutation symmetry is wicked cool.
So if I understand this correctly, you get this ordering by going to a higher symmetry group as
I'll see if I can answer your question. What I mean is, right, is that it's maybe let me even show a picture. It's easier in three, right? So in the limit of infinite interactions, then there's no tunneling between these sectors. And so there's no so really this sector is completely disconnected from the other sectors. And I don't just have to think about switching particles 1 and 2. I could just randomly switch that sector and that sector, right? I don't have to think about particle switching around. I can literally just think of each of these six sections as independent systems that are identical.
Group theory gives you all possibilities in a crystal structure.
Right.
And if I take the symmetry basis based on that, I can construct my wave functions.
That's right.
I need to plug it into my Hamiltonian and see which one gives me the ground state. But that's really the true one. The rest of it would be exciting.
So this does. Great question. Yeah. In fact, let's see if I can explain it. I can at least show a picture. Maybe I'll skip. How am I doing on time? Yeah, okay. I was just going to say, for example, harmonic oscillators have U1 symmetry. There, I'll just say that, right? In other words, just because it might be useful in your brain, I'll skip some stuff and just go straight to this chart that I'm talking about. In fact, and this really is the key to what's called the Girardot result, is that there is actually a mapping that you can get. Hold on a second. Wrong chart slide. I do that again. Yeah, that's too much. That's too much stuff, isn't it? Right. There's actually so. Let me first explain what I mean by this chart. Yeah. Say I have three particles in an arbitrary trap. Okay. Now, in a harmonic oscillator trap, and so these numbers represent the excitations of each of the particles. If I had a harmonic oscillator trap, then each of these rows would all have the same energy. If I don't know the trap, I don't know. I still know no excitations is the ground state, one excitation is the first excited state. But if I don't know the trap, I don't know whether two particles excited once has more or less energy than one particle excited twice. So that's what this chart and the arrows represent. I can put a partial ordering on the energy eigenspaces without knowing the trap shape. I can only put a partial ordering. A concept that I didn't even know in math until sort of trying to figure out what I'm doing here. These numbers up here tell me how many states are in each of these energy eigenspaces. What Girardot and Tonks, or I don't know what Tonks thought, but what Girardot figured out was that there was a direct mapping between the bosonic state there and its unitary limit here, and that you can literally adiabatically tune that state to that state and trace out its energy as a function of g. Now, can you do it analytically? No, but you know that the line connects, you know there's no crossings, you know, and you can do weak perturbation theory from the non-interacting side, and you can do weak perturbation from, or nearly unitary perturbation theory from the unitary side, and you could figure out how those ones map to each other. Does that answer your question? Right.
And actually, which one provides eventually to the free energy calculation?
So, are you talking about them? I don't do this because I don't do many body physics. I do few body physics, and so I actually haven't thought about the free energy in a few body context.
Well, you did show a V of Q, right? That was your free energy functional, the Q
squared.
That was
my trap. Yeah, that was my trap. Yeah, yeah.
Your trap, inside your trap, the free energy. If I go to the continuum limit, the h bar squared over 2m will become a gradient of phi squared term. The vx will become some sort of a quartic interaction, if there are any, and the rest of it will be the phi fields. I mean, irrespective of that, it's just my question was just if group theory gives me more than I need, to be honest, to know what is really physical.
Yeah.
That g in that coupling that you have somehow has to be related to the microscopics of your trap. What the energy scale is.
Yeah.
Because once you impose that energy scale, and maybe that's the, you have it in a slide coming up, that a lot of these would evaporate and the only one which survives are three of them.
So that's a great question, right? And that's what in a trapped system universality means, is that when you take G goes to infinity, the energy scales are determined completely by the trap shape.
Okay.
So I understand what you're saying now, right?
That was my question.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's right. And so at the unitary limit, it's just the trap shape. That's exactly right. And that's what I was trying to say with this chart, is that in the unitary limit, the ground state maps to that. Like, I can show you a picture of it. Let's see. So, for example, this is the ground state. Here is the first fermionic state, right? And it's up here at 9/2. So this is for a harmonic trap. What you find is in the unitary limit, so the fermionic state, it's invariant under these two body interactions because in the contact interaction, there's only energy cost if the particles coincide for a contact interaction. But for a totally anti-symmetric state, it's zero there. There's no support in the wave function where the interaction is in configuration space. So the fermionic state is unchanged in the unitary limit. And what you find, this is Girardot, the bosonic state is just the absolute value of that. And then you can talk about states with mixed symmetry. And these six states are degenerate in energy at the unitary limit. And so then there's a sort of a game like, oh, well, this state could be two bosons and something else, and this could be, you know, right? And so that's a whole symmetry game that I haven't really talked about. And maybe I won't talk about. And maybe I ought to start winding down. Symmetry. Ordering. Permutation. Yeah. Well, you know how you work on something for a long time, and then you have a chance to talk about it, you get a little, you sort of want to talk about every single thing you've ever thought about in your entire life. You know what I'm talking about? Anybody like that? So what I'll go to is maybe, so I'm going to start summarizing. So one way to think about what I'm doing is how much does symmetry give you? As you're saying, does it give you too much? Does it not give you enough? For two particle, it gives you a bounty. Right? You actually don't even need to know anything about the trap to know things like, well, the bosonic state is going to have a bigger energy shift than the fermionic state. You know how the level splittings are going to go without having to worry about the trap at all. The two-body problem is integrable for any two bodies. You have conservation momentum or an energy. You don't have conservation momentum in a trap, but you still have enough. You can always integrate the two-body problem for any potential. It works. You go to three particles. Well, you need a little bit more. First off, it turns out there's a big difference for three particles whether the trap is symmetric or not symmetric. When the trap is symmetric, then everything is basically automatic. If the trap is anti-symmetric, then then it depends what the trap shape is, on how the levels split, on how they map to each other. And I could go into more detail, but that's the thing, this is an incremental thing with three dimensions. One important thing about three particles is that the permutation group of three particles has intrinsically multidimensional representations, and that just adds this extra complication. You have these extra degeneracies that you always have to be thinking about. You go to four particles, as you might expect, you need even more information. If you have symmetry, you still only have to solve a quadratic equation. If it's a symmetric trap, you still only have to solve the quadratic equation. If it's asymmetric, again, you still need some trap shape information for both the symmetric and the anti-symmetric. You need trap shape information. But if it's anti-symmetric, you have to solve a cubic equation. Well, so you see how this is slowly slipping away as we add particles. Has anybody read Watership Down? It's a book about rabbits from the 70s. It's Richard Adams about rabbits trying to leave a dystopia, explore some other dystopias, and create their own utopia. How high can rabbits count? Four. In that book, rabbits can count to four, and everything more than four is just rare. Because it just like that's beyond what a rabbit can do. Well, guess what? Five, man, there's a little bit of four-particle results. Five particles, meh. That's more than algebra can do for the same reason, right? Because again, the weak limit, so we need even more information as we would expect. The trap shape itself, and if you're not dealing with a contact interaction, the exact interaction properties become more and more important to determine the level splittings at the non-interacting and strongly interacting limits. But even then, no matter, even if you had perfect information, even if that information was knowable but not known, right? Because right, I'm looking for a universal. I don't want to have to know A, B, C, D, E to solve the problem. I just want to know if there's an A, B, C, D, E, is there a solution? And the answer is no, right? And so I don't know much about the stability of higher order polynomial roots, but I know it's tricky, right? And so I'm trying to lead to what I get there. I'll tell you the truth, five is different, but if you have a symmetric trap with five particles, you can still do it by solving a cubic, okay? But if you have an asymmetric trap, again, then that's the limit, and six and beyond, it's broken forever. It's broken.
I have a question. You know, quantum chemists, when they take molecules, those they construct later determinants
right.
of the molecule, right? And this is your superposition of those configurations, and they call it configuration interaction state theory.
That's right.
You see this huge C1 times a determinant, the C2 times a determinant.
That's right.
I'm just curious to know, when you get up to five particles, so numerically, I mean, algebraically, I understand there's not a solution, but even numerically, it can be solved.
Oh, so numerically, it can be solved.
Okay.
For any particular value of A, B, C, D, and E, I can do Newton's method, right? I can converge on roots by however I want to. But I don't have a universal result in this sense. And maybe it's a technical sense, right? But I think it's an important technical sense, because if I vary A, B, C, D a little bit, the movement of the roots of that equation are not as controllable as when I have a universal algebraic solution where I know how if I change this parameter a little bit, I get a little where I go in that space. So this is a technical thing, right? But I think it's an important technical thing. So here are my conclusions. integrability in few body systems is rare and beautiful, and for the reasons I've tried to explain, especially with more than five particles. It is so rare and beautiful that they have invented an executive ball clicker for the wealthiest among us to appreciate integrability. The group theoretical methods, again, provide tools for spectroscopic analysis. Some of this, is, by the way, is original. A lot of this, if I was going to say one name who presaged some of this but did it a little differently, is a guy named Gaudin. I mean, Yang and Gaudin. And this is related to Yang-Baxter equations and all that kind of stuff, although I don't quite understand all that yet. But one of the big results here, the Bethe-Ansatz, is you could sort of think about the symmetries that give you your quantum numbers are like a kaleidoscope in configuration space. And all the possible kaleidoscopes for a given dimension, that tells you something about what's integrable in that dimension of configuration space. And so I found a kaleidoscope in my atom trap. And finally, and here's the thing I promised, but I didn't deliver, is that I claim that when you lose algebraic solvability, this kind of algebraic universality in this sense, you lose some notion of controllability. Have I made that into a well-defined idea? No. Is that speculative? Yes. Does it feel right? Yes. It feels right. Thanks for your time.
One of the things these systems remind me of a bit is looking at Calogero-Calogero-Sutherland.
Sorry, you betcha.
One of the things models Calogero and Calogero-Sutherland models, and in particular, right, if you can take the Calogero model where you have harmonic traps and a 1 over x1 minus x2 squared potential, and those are integrable.
Mm-hmm.
And in the particular case of the Calogero, but not Calogero-Sutherland, which has a trigonometric term, there is actually an algebraic method due to shape invariance for finding the solutions.
I don't know the shape invariant method.
Which I'm
but
a little bitter about because Costas and I found a way into both of those partway. Then other people actually.
You've worked with Costas before. Yeah.
So, but there's another group which actually figured out how to do it all the way through for the Calogero model.
Yeah.
And that might actually be an angle into understanding what the features are that allow for exact solvability. It's not strictly the same as the algebraic sense, but it's very close.
So I got two comments on that. I mean, one other perspective on this that I haven't mentioned is that when a system is integrable for these kinds of systems, one way to say it is because there's a non-diffractive scattering. And one way you could sort of think about that is this, again, in terms of an effective three-body interaction. If there's non-diffractive scattering, the way these things scatter doesn't matter on the wave function of the third particle. And that's what sort of relates. I mean, like Sutherland's book on beautiful models, he builds his whole sort of perspective on this based on this concept of non-diffractive scattering. Literally, what I was working on before I came down here was I had the idea related to this, right? What if I take a Calogero or some kind of related model and try to get this model, do perturbation theory from that model to a general G? Because those could be solvable for any G. You have to make some sort of, you have to understand how the G in this model relates to the G in that model. But yeah, so I think that's a really cool thing, and you that's good.
And the people who, it's Avinash Kare and I think Sukatme, and maybe there's a third author who did the shape invariance on the Calogero model. Anyway,
I will take that reference from you.
So I just want to understand this algebraic solvability question, because if you look at the Lieb-Linegar model,
right,
it's integrable for any number.
You betcha.
But it's transcendental solvability, is that right?
That's right. So it is transcendentally solvable for any G, algebraically solvable for G equals zero and G equals infinity, but also algebraically solvable perturbations. In other words, you could do weak perturbations, and for any number of particles, the weak perturbation problem and the strong perturbation problem are also algebraically solvable. I mean, I know this is sort of technical to try to focus on algebraic solvability of the perturbation theory, right? But that's to me where the thing is, because once you move away from these integrable, you're wading into thermalized ergodic mess, right? And so I even want to know whether the first step is algebraic or whether any step is, you know, yeah. crazy.
I'm interested in the low-lying states. So take the case of, say, a circular well with a, you know, zero potential.
And in 2D?
No, 1D.
Okay. Oh, a ring. Okay, a ring.
A ring, right. Yeah, okay. And G, you know, not necessarily infinitely repelling. So the question, so there's some ground state. What do you know the dispersion relation for the excitations?
Yeah. Well, I don't, but yes, that problem is solved. That is the Lieb, what's called the Lieb-Linegar model if they're fermions, and it's called something else if they're bosons. That is, and it's solved by the beta-ansatz. So that is exactly solved by the beta-ansatz for any n, and has convergent properties in the thermodynamic limit. I mean, so it's well-behaved in the thermodynamic limit.
What's the name again of those n?
So the beta ansatz, Lieb-Linegar. Yeah, I'm flipping back through here because I think I have it in the Khaleesi slide. Yeah. So I mean, I'm not saying that that's necessarily the best place to start. For the record, I really like the work of Murray Batchelor. I find whatever he writes with his collaborator Guan especially is very readable. But yeah, Lieb-Linegar, that's how I say that. Again, if you make them, now I forget, maybe Lieb-Linegar is bosons, and then Yang-Gaudin is fermions. I think Yang-Gaudin is two-component fermions, and then you can generalize this to multi-component fermions or bosons. There's interesting effects in that particular case. One of the ones that's a little hot right now is Wigner crystallization, right? That's one of the physical effects they're studying there. So. You all have to eat.
Any further questions? Well, Nate, thanks for a very nice talk.